She could see through his missing cheek to his upper and lower molars, and the tongue glistening and hideously long. Further up, where she hardly dared look, were the exposed muscles around his eye socket. So intimate and never intended to be seen. Private Latimer had become a monster, and he must have guessed this was so. Did a girl love him before? Could she continue to? "We'll soon have you fixed," she lied again. She began repacking his face with clean gauze soaked in Eusol. As she was securing the pins, he made his sad sound. "Shall I bring you the bottle?" He shook his head and made the sound again. "You're uncomfortable?" "No." "Water?" A nod. Only a small corner of his lips remained. She inserted the little teapot spout and poured. With each swallow he winced, which in turn caused him agony around the missing muscles of his face. He could stand no more, but as she withdrew the water pot, he raised a hand toward her wrist. He had to have more, rather pain than thirst. And so it went on for minutes. He couldn't bear the pain. He had to have the water. She would have stayed with him, but there was always another job, always a sister demanding help or a soldier calling from his bed. She had a break from the wards when a man coming round from an anaesthetic was sick onto her lap and she had to find a clean apron. She was surprised to see from a corridor window that it was dark outside. 5 hours had passed since they came back from the park. She was by the linen store, tying her apron, when Sister Drummond came up. It was hard to say what had changed. The manner was still quietly remote, the orders unchallengeable. Perhaps beneath the self-discipline, a touch of rapport in adversity. "Nurse, you'll go and help apply the bunion bags to Corporal McIntyre's arms and legs. You'll treat the rest of his body with tannic acid. If there are difficulties, you'll come straight to me." She turned away to give instructions to another nurse. Bryony had seen them bring the corporal in. He was one of a number of men overwhelmed by burning oil on a sinking ferry off Dunkirk. He was picked out of the water by a destroyer. The viscous oil clung to the skin and seared through the tissue. It was the burned-out remains of a human they lifted onto the bed. She thought he could never survive. It was not easy to find a vein to give him morphine. Sometime in the past 2 hours, she had helped 2 other nurses lift him onto a bedpan, and he had screamed at the first touch of their hands. The bunion bags were big cellophane containers. The damaged limb floated inside, cushioned by saline solution that had to be at exactly the right temperature. A variation of 1 degree was not tolerated. As Bryony came up, a probationer with a Primus stove on a trolley was already preparing the fresh solution. The bags had to be changed frequently. Corporal McIntyre lay on his back under a bed cradle because he could not bear the touch of a sheet on his skin. He was whimpering pathetically for water. Burn cases were always badly dehydrated. His lips were too ruined, too swollen, and his tongue too blistered for him to be given fluid by mouth. His saline drip had come away. The needle would not hold in place in the damaged vein. A qualified nurse she had never seen before was attaching a new bag to the stand. Bryony prepared the tannic acid in a bowl and took the roll of cotton wool. She thought she would start with the corporal's legs in order to be out of the way of the nurse who was beginning to search his blackened arm looking for a vein. But the nurse said, "Who sent you over here?" "Sister Drummond." The nurse spoke tersely and did not look up from her probing. "He's suffering too much. I don't want him treated until I get him hydrated. Go and find something else to do." Bryony did as she was told. She did not know how much later it was. Perhaps it was in the small hours when she was sent to get fresh towels. She saw the nurse standing near the entrance to the duty room, unobtrusively crying. Corporal McIntyre was dead. His bed was already taken by another case. The probationers and the second-year students worked 12 hours without rest. The other trainees and the qualified nurses worked on, and no one could remember how long they were in the wards. All the training she had received, Bryony felt later, had been useful preparation, especially in obedience. But everything she understood about nursing, she learned that night. She had never seen men crying before. It shocked her at first, and within the hour she was used to it. On the other hand, the stoicism of some of the soldiers amazed and even appalled her. Men coming round from amputations seemed compelled to make terrible jokes. "What am I going to kick the missus with now?" Every secret of the body was rendered up, bone risen through flesh, sacrilegious glimpses of an intestine or an optic nerve. From this new and intimate perspective, she learned a simple, obvious thing she had always known and everyone knew, that a person is, among all else, a material thing, easily torn, not easily mended. She came the closest she would ever be to the battlefield, for every case she helped with had some of its essential elements: blood, oil, sand, mud, seawater, bullets, shrapnel, engine grease, or the smell of cordite or damp, sweaty battle dress, whose pockets contained rancid food along with the sodden crumbs of ammo bars. Often, when she returned yet again to the sink with the high taps and the soda block, it was beach sand she scrubbed away from between her fingers. She and the other probationers of her set were aware of each other only as nurses, not as friends. She barely registered that one of the girls who had helped to move Corporal McIntyre onto the bedpan was Fiona. Sometimes, when a soldier Bryony was looking after was in great pain, she was touched by an impersonal tenderness that detached her from the suffering, so that she was able to do her work efficiently and without horror. That was when she saw what nursing might be, and she longed to qualify, to have that badge. She could imagine how she might abandon her ambitions of writing and dedicate her life in return for these moments of elated, generalized love. Toward 3:30 in the morning, she was told to go and see Sister Drummond. She was on her own, making up a bed. Earlier, Bryony had seen her in the sluice room. She seemed to be everywhere, doing jobs at every level. Automatically, Bryony began to help her. The sister said, "I seem to remember that you speak a bit of French." "It's only school French, sister." She nodded toward the end of the ward. "You see that soldier sitting up at the end of the row? Acute surgical, but there's no need to wear a mask. Find a chair, go and sit with him. Hold his hand and talk to him." Bryony could not help feeling offended. "But I'm not tired, sister. Honestly, I'm not." "You'll do as you're told." "Yes, sister." He looked like a boy of 15, but she saw from his chart that he was her own age, 18. He was sitting, propped by several pillows, watching the commotion around him with a kind of abstracted, childlike wonder. It was hard to think of him as a soldier. He had a fine, delicate face, with dark eyebrows and dark green eyes, and a soft, full mouth. His face was white and had an unusual sheen, and the eyes were unhealthily radiant. His head was heavily bandaged. As she brought up her chair and sat down, he smiled as though he had been expecting her, and when she took his hand, he did not seem surprised. "Te voilà, enfant?" The French vowels had a musical twang, but she could just about understand him. His hand was cold and greasy to the touch. She said, The sister told me to come and have a little chat with you. Not knowing the word, she translated sister literally.
Your sister is very kind.
Then he cocked his head and added,
But she always was. And is all going well for her? What does she do these days?
There was such friendliness and charm in his eyes, such boyish eagerness to engage her, that she could only go along.
She's a nurse too.
Of course.
You told me before. Is she still happy? Did she get married to that man she loves so well? Do you know, I can't remember his name. I hope you'll forgive me. Since my injury, my memory has been poor. But they tell me it will soon come back. What was his name?
Robbie, but...
And they're married now and happy?
I hope they will be soon.
I'm so happy for her.
You haven't told me your name.
Luc. Luc Connet. And yours?
She hesitated. Talis.
Talis. That's very pretty.
The way he pronounced it, it was. He looked away from her face and gazed at the ward, turning his head slowly, quietly amazed. Then he closed his eyes and began to ramble, speaking softly under his breath. Her vocabulary was not good enough to follow him easily. She caught,
You count them slowly in your hand, on your fingers, my mother's scarf. You choose the colour, and you have to live with it.
He fell silent for some minutes. His hand tightened its grip on hers. When he spoke again, his eyes were still closed.
Do you want to know something odd? This is my first time in Paris.
Luc, you're in London. Soon we'll be sending you home.
They said that the people would be cold and unfriendly, but the opposite is true. They're very kind, and you're very kind. Coming to see me again?
For a while, she thought he might have fallen asleep. Sitting, for the first time in hours, she felt her own fatigue gathering behind her eyes. Then he was looking about him with that same slow turn of the head, and then he looked at her and said,
Of course, you're the girl with the English accent.
She said, Tell me what you did before the war. Where did you live? Can you remember?
Do you remember that Easter, when you came to Millau?
Feebly he swung her hand from side to side as he spoke, as though to stir her memory, and his dark green eyes scanned her face in anticipation. She thought it wasn't right to lead him on.
I've never been to Millau. Do you remember the first time you came in our shop?
She pulled her chair nearer the bed. His pale, oily face gleamed and bobbed in front of her eyes. Luc, I want you to listen to me.
I think it was my mother who served you, or perhaps it was one of my sisters. I was working with my father on the ovens at the back. I heard your accent and came to take a look at you.
I want to tell you where you are. You're not in Paris.
Then you were back the next day, and this time I was there and you said...
Soon you can sleep. I'll come and see you tomorrow. I promise. Luc raised his hand to his head and frowned. He said in a lower voice,
I wanted to ask you a little favour, Talis.
Of course.
These bandages are so tight. Will you loosen them for me a little?
She stood and peered down at his head. The gauze bows were tied for easy release. As she gently pulled the ends away, he said,
My youngest sister Anne, do you remember her? She's the prettiest girl in Millau. She passed a grade exam with a tiny piece by Debussy, so full of light and fun. Anyway, that's what Anne says. It keeps running through my mind. Perhaps you know it.
He hummed a few random notes. She was uncoiling the layer of gauze.
No one knows where she got a gift from. The rest of our family is completely hopeless. When she plays, her back is so straight. She never smiles till she reaches the end. That's beginning to feel better. I think it was Anne who served you the first time you came into the shop.
She was not intending to remove the gauze, but as she loosened it, the heavy sterile towel beneath it slid away, taking a part of the blooded dressing with it. The side of Luke's head was missing. The hair was shaved well back from the missing portion of skull. Below the jagged line of bone was a spongy crimson mess of brain, several inches across, reaching from the crown almost to the tip of his ear. She caught the towel before it slipped to the floor, and she held it while she waited for her nausea to pass. Only now did it occur to her what a foolish and unprofessional thing she had done. Luke sat quietly waiting for her. She glanced down the ward. No one was paying attention. She replaced the sterile towel, fixed the gauze, and retied the bows. When she sat down again, she found his hand and tried to steady herself in its cold, moist grip. Luke was rambling again.
I don't smoke. I promised my ration to Jeannot. Look, it's all over the table, under the flowers now. The rabbit can't hear you, stupid.
Then words came in a torrent, and she lost him. Later she caught a reference to a schoolmaster who was too strict, or perhaps it was an army officer. Finally he was quiet. She wiped his sweating face with a damp towel and waited. When he opened his eyes, he resumed their conversation as though there had been no interlude.
What did you think of our baguettes and ficelle?
Delicious.
That was why you came every day.
Yes. He paused to consider this. Then he said cautiously, raising a delicate matter,
And our croissant?
The best in Millau. He smiled. When he spoke, there was a grating sound at the back of his throat, which they both ignored.
It's my father's special recipe. It all depends on the quality of butter.
He was gazing at her in rapture. He brought his free hand to cover hers. He said,
You know that my mother is very fond of you.
Is she?
She talks about you all the time. She thinks we should be married in the summer.
She held his gaze. She knew now why she had been sent. He was having difficulty swallowing, and drops of sweat were forming on his brow, along the edge of the dressing and along his upper lip. She wiped them away and was about to reach the water for him, but he said,
Do you love me?
She hesitated. Yes. No other reply was possible. Besides, for that moment she did. He was a lovely boy who was a long way from his family, and he was about to die. She gave him some water. While she was wiping his face again, he said,
Have you ever been on the Côte de Larzac?
No, I've never been there. But he did not offer to take her. Instead, he turned his head away into the pillow, and soon he was murmuring his unintelligible scraps. His grip on her hand remained tight, as though he were aware of her presence. When he became lucid again, he turned his head toward her.
You won't leave just yet?
Of course not.
I'll stay with you. Talis.
Still smiling, he half closed his eyes. Suddenly he jerked upright, as if an electric current had been applied to his limbs. He was gazing at her in surprise, with his lips parted. Then he tipped forward and seemed to lunge at her. She jumped up from her chair to prevent him toppling to the floor. His hands still held hers, and his free arm was around her neck. His forehead was pressed into her shoulder, his cheek was against hers. She was afraid the sterile towel would slip from his head. She thought she could not support his weight or bear to see his wound again. The grating sound from deep in his throat resounded in her ear. Staggering, she eased him onto the bed and settled him back on the pillows. "It's Bryony," she said, so only he would hear. His eyes had a wide-open look of astonishment, and his waxy skin gleamed in the electric light. She moved closer and put her lips to his ear. Behind her was a presence, and then a hand resting on her shoulder. "It's not Talise. You should call me Bryony," she whispered, as the hand reached over to touch hers and loosened her fingers from the boy's. "Stand up now, Nurse Talise." Sister Drummond took her elbow and helped her to her feet. The sister's cheek patches were bright, and across the cheekbones the pink skin met the white in a precise straight line. On the other side of the bed, a nurse drew the sheet over Luc Cornet's face. Pursing her lips, the sister straightened Brian's collar. "There's a good girl. Now go and wash the blood from your face. We don't want the other patients upset." She did as she was told, and went to the lavatories and washed her face in cold water, and minutes later returned to her duties in the ward. At 4:30 in the morning, the probationers were sent to their lodgings to sleep and told to report back at 11. Bryony walked with Fiona. Neither girl spoke, and when they linked arms, it seemed they were resuming, after a lifetime of experience, their walk across Westminster Bridge. They could not have begun to describe their time in the wards, or how it had changed them. It was enough to be able to keep walking down the empty corridors behind the other girls. When she had said her good nights and entered her tiny room, Bryony found a letter on the floor. The handwriting on the envelope was unfamiliar. One of the girls must have picked it up at the porter's lodge and pushed it under her door. Rather than open it straight away, she undressed and prepared herself for sleep. She sat on her bed in her nightdress with the letter in her lap and thought about the boy. The corner of sky in her window was already white. She could still hear his voice, the way he said Talise, turning it into a girl's name. She imagined the unavailable future, the boulangerie in a narrow, shady street swarming with skinny cats, piano music from an upstairs window, her giggling sisters-in-law teasing her about her accent, and Luc Cornet loving her in his eager way. She would have liked to cry for him, and for his family in Millau, who would be waiting to hear news from him. But she couldn't feel a thing. She was empty.
This ends Disc 10. Atonement, Disc 11.
She sat for almost half an hour in a daze, and then at last, exhausted but not sleepy, she tied her hair back with the ribbon she always used, got into bed, and opened the letter. "Dear Miss Talise, thank you for sending us two figures by a fountain, and please accept our apologies for this dilatory response. As you must know, it would be unusual for us to publish a complete novella by an unknown writer, or, for that matter, a well-established one. However, we did read with an eye to an extract we might take. Unfortunately, we are not able to take any of it. I am returning the typescript under separate cover.
That said, we found ourselves, initially against our better judgment, for there is much to do in this office, reading the whole with great interest. Though we cannot offer to publish any part of it, we thought you should know that in this quarter there are others as well as myself who would take an interest in what you might write in the future. We are not complacent about the average age of our contributors and are keen to publish promising young writers. We would like to see whatever you do, especially if you were to write a short story or two. We found two figures by a fountain arresting enough to read with dedicated attention. I do not say this lightly. We cast aside a great deal of material, some of it by writers of reputation. There are some good images. I liked the long grass stalked by the leonine yellow of high summer. And you both capture a flow of thought and represent it with subtle differences in order to make attempts at characterization. Something unique and unexplained is caught. However, we wondered whether it owed a little too much to the techniques of Mrs. Wolfe. The crystalline present moment is, of course, a worthy subject in itself, especially for poetry. It allows a writer to show his gifts, delve into mysteries of perception, present a stylized version of thought processes, permit the vagaries and unpredictability of the private self to be explored, and so on. Who can doubt the value of this experimentation? However, such writing can become precious when there is no sense of forward movement. Put the other way round, our attention would have been held even more effectively had there been an underlying pull of simple narrative. Development is required. So, for example, the child at the window, whose account we read first, her fundamental lack of grasp of the situation is nicely caught. So too is the resolve in her that follows, and the sense of initiation into grown-up mysteries. We catch this young girl at the dawn of her selfhood. One is intrigued by her resolve to abandon the fairy stories and homemade folk tales and plays she has been writing. How much nicer if we had the flavour of one. But she may have thrown the baby of fictional technique out with the folk tale water. For all the fine rhythms and nice observations, nothing much happens after a beginning that has such promise. A young man and woman by a fountain, who clearly have a great deal of unresolved feeling between them, tussle over a Ming vase and break it. More than one of us here thought Ming rather too priceless to take outdoors. Wouldn't Sèvres or Nymphenburg suit your purpose? The woman goes fully dressed into the fountain to retrieve the pieces. Wouldn't it help you if the watching girl did not actually realize that the vase had broken? It would be all the more of a mystery to her that the woman submerges herself. So much might unfold from what you have, but you dedicate scores of pages to the quality of light and shade and to random impressions. Then we have matters from the man's view, then the woman's, though we don't really learn much that is fresh. Just more about the look and feel of things and some irrelevant memories. The man and woman part leaving a damp patch on the ground which rapidly evaporates, and there we have reached the end. This static quality does not serve your evident talent well. If this girl has so fully misunderstood or been so wholly baffled by the strange little scene that has unfolded before her, how might it affect the lives of the two adults? Might she come between them in some disastrous fashion? Or bring them closer, either by design or accident? Might she innocently expose them somehow to the young woman's parents, perhaps? They surely would not approve of a liaison between their eldest daughter and their charlady's son. Might the young couple come to use her as a messenger? In other words, rather than dwell for quite so long on the perceptions of each of the three figures, would it not be possible to set them before us with greater economy, still keeping some of the vivid writing about light and stone and water, which you do so well, but then move on to create some tension, some light and shade within the narrative itself? Your most sophisticated readers might be well up on the latest Bergsonian theories of consciousness, but I'm sure they retain a childlike desire to be told a story, to be held in suspense, to know what happens. Incidentally, from your description, the Bernini you refer to is the one in the Piazza Barberini, not the Piazza Navona. Simply put, you need the backbone of a story. It may interest you to know that one of your avid readers was Mrs. Elizabeth Bowen. She picked up the bundle of typescript in an idle moment while passing through this office on her way to luncheon, asked to take it home to read, and finished it that afternoon. Initially, she thought the prose too full, too cloying, but with redeeming shades of dusty answer, which I wouldn't have thought of at all. Then she was hooked for a while, and finally she gave us some notes which are, as it were, mulched into the above. You may feel perfectly satisfied with your pages as they stand, or our reservations may fill you with dismissive anger or such despair you never want to look at the thing again. We sincerely hope not. Our wish is that you will take our remarks, which are given with sincere enthusiasm, as a basis for another draft. Your covering letter was admirably reticent, but you did hint that you had almost no free time at present. If that should change and you are passing this way, we would be more than happy to see you over a glass of wine and discuss this further. We hope you will not be discouraged. It may help you to know that our letters of rejection are usually no more than 3 sentences long. You apologize, in passing, for not writing about the war. We will be sending you a copy of our most recent issue with a relevant editorial. As you will see, we do not believe that artists have an obligation to strike up attitudes to the war. Indeed, they are wise and right to ignore it and devote themselves to other subjects. Since artists are politically impotent, they must use this time to develop at deeper emotional levels. Your work, your war work, is to cultivate your talent and to go in the direction it demands. Warfare, as we remarked, is the enemy of creative activity. Your address suggests you may be either a doctor or suffering from a long illness. If the latter, then all of us wish you a speedy and successful recovery. Finally, one of us here wonders whether you have an older sister who was at Girton 6 or 7 years ago. Yours sincerely, C.C. In the days that followed, the reversion to a strict shift system dispelled the sense of floating timelessness of those first 24 hours. She counted herself lucky to be on days, 7 till 8, with half hours for meals. When her alarm sounded at 5:45, she drifted upward from a soft pit of exhaustion, and in the several seconds of no man's land between sleep and full consciousness, she became aware of some excitement in store, a treat, or a momentous change. Waking as a child on Christmas Day was like this, the sleepy thrill, before remembering its source. With her eyes still closed against the summer morning brightness in the room, she fumbled for the button on her clock and sank back into her pillow, and then it came back to her. The very opposite of Christmas, in fact. The opposite of everything. The Germans were about to invade. Everybody said it was so, from the porters who were forming their own hospital local defence volunteers unit, to Churchill himself, who conjured an image of the country subjugated and starving, with only the Royal Navy still at large.
Bryony knew it would be dreadful, that there would be hand-to-hand fighting in the streets and public hangings, a descent into slavery, and the destruction of everything decent. But as she sat on the edge of her rumpled, still warm bed, pulling on her stockings, she could not prevent or deny her horrible exhilaration. As everyone kept saying, the country stood alone now, and it was better that way. Already things looked different. The fleur-de-lis pattern on her wash bag, the chipped plaster frame of the mirror, her face in it as she brushed her hair, all looked brighter in sharper focus. The doorknob in her hand as she turned it felt obtrusively cool and hard. When she stepped into the corridor and heard distant heavy footsteps in the stairwell, she thought of German jackboots, and her stomach lurched. Before breakfast, she had a minute or two to herself along the walkway by the river. Even at this hour, under a clear sky, there was a ferocious sparkle in its tidal freshness as it slid past the hospital. Was it really possible that the Germans could own the Thames? The clarity of everything she saw or touched or heard was certainly not prompted by the fresh beginnings and abundance of early summer. It was an inflamed awareness of an approaching conclusion, of events converging on an end point. These were the last days, she felt, and they would shine in the memory in a particular way. This brightness, this long spell of sunny days, was history's last fling before another stretch of time began. The early morning duties, the sluice room, the taking round of tea, the changing of dressings, and the renewed contact with all the irreparable damage did not dim this heightened perception. It conditioned everything she did and was a constant background. And it gave an urgency to her plans. She felt she did not have much time. If she delayed, she thought, the Germans might arrive and she might never have another chance. Fresh cases arrived each day, but no longer in a deluge. The system was taking hold and there was a bed for everyone. The surgical cases were prepared for the basement operating theatres. Afterward, most patients were sent off to outlying hospitals to convalesce. The turnover among the dead was high, and for the probationers there was no drama now, only routine. The screens drawn round the padre's bedside murmur, the sheet pulled up, the porters called, the bed stripped and remade. How quickly the dead faded into each other, so that Sergeant Mooney's face became Private Lowell's, and both exchanged their fatal wounds with those of other men whose names they could no longer recall. Now France had fallen, it was assumed that the bombing of London, the softening up, must soon begin. No one was to stay in the city unnecessarily. The sandbagging on the ground floor windows was reinforced, and civilian contractors were on the roofs, checking the firmness of the chimney stacks and the concreted skylights. There were various rehearsals for evacuating the wards, with much stern shouting and blowing of whistles. There were fire drills too, and assembly point procedures, and fitting gas masks on incapable or unconscious patients. The nurses were reminded to put their own masks on first. They were no longer terrorized by Sister Drummond. Now they had been blooded, she did not speak to them like schoolgirls. Her tone when she gave instructions was cool, professionally neutral, and they were flattered. In this new environment, it was relatively easy for Bryony to arrange to swap her day off with Fiona, who generously gave up her Saturday for a Monday. Because of an administrative bungle, some soldiers were left to convalesce in the hospital. Once they had slept off their exhaustion and got used to regular meals again and regained some weight, the mood was sour or surly, even among those without permanent disabilities. They were infantrymen, mostly. They lay on their beds smoking, silently staring at the ceiling, brooding over their recent memories. Or they gathered to talk in mutinous little groups. They were disgusted with themselves. A few of them told Bryony they had never even fired a shot. But mostly they were angry with the brass, and with their own officers for abandoning them in the retreat, and with the French for collapsing without a fight. They were bitter about the newspaper celebrations of the miracle evacuation and the heroism of the little boats. "A fucking shambles," she heard them mutter. "Fucking RAF." Some men were even unfriendly and uncooperative about their medicines, having managed to blur the distinction between the generals and the nurses. All mindless authority as far as they were concerned. It took a visit from Sister Drummond to set them straight. On Saturday morning, Bryony left the hospital at 8 without eating breakfast and walked with the river on her right upstream. As she passed the gates of Lambeth Palace, 3 buses went by. All the destination boards were blank now. Confusion to the invader. It did not matter because she had already decided to walk. It was of no help that she had memorized a few street names. All the signs had been taken down or blacked out. Her vague idea was to go along the river a couple of miles and then head off to the left, which should be south. Most plans and maps of the city had been confiscated by order. Finally, she had managed to borrow a crumbling bus route map dated 1926. It was torn along its folds, right along the line of the way she wanted to take. Opening it was to risk breaking it in pieces, and she was nervous of the kind of impression she would make. There were stories in the paper of German parachutists disguised as nurses and nuns, spreading out through the cities and infiltrating the population. They were to be identified by the maps they might sometimes consult, and on questioning, by their too perfect English and their ignorance of common nursery rhymes. Once the idea was in her mind, she could not stop thinking about how suspicious she looked. She had thought her uniform would protect her as she crossed unknown territory. Instead, she looked like a spy. As she walked against the flow of morning traffic, she ran through the nursery rhymes she remembered. There were very few she could have recited all the way through. Ahead of her, a milkman had got down from his cart to tighten the girth straps of his horse. He was murmuring to the animal as she came up. Briefly, there came back to her, as she stood behind him and politely cleared her throat, a memory of old Hardman and his trap. Anyone who was, say, 70 now, would have been her age in 1888. Still the age of the horse, at least on the streets, and the old men hated to let it go. When she asked him the way, the milkman was friendly enough and gave a long, indistinct account of the route. He was a large fellow with a tobacco-stained white beard. He suffered from an adenoidal problem that made his words bleed into each other through a humming sound in his nostrils. He waved her toward a road forking to the left under a railway bridge. She thought it might be too soon to be leaving the river, but as she walked on, she sensed him watching her and thought it would be impolite to disregard his directions. Perhaps the left fork was a shortcut. She was surprised by how clumsy and self-conscious she was after all she had learned and seen. She felt inept, unnerved by being out on her own and no longer part of her group. For months, she had lived a closed life whose every hour was marked by a timetable. She knew her humble place in the ward. As she became more proficient in the work, so she became better at taking orders and following procedures and ceasing to think for herself. It was a long time since she had done anything on her own. Not since her week in Primrose Hill, typing out the novella, and what a foolish excitement that seemed now. She was walking under the bridge as a train passed overhead. The thunderous rhythmic rumble reached right into her bones. Steel gliding and thumping over steel, the great bolted sheets of it high above her in the gloom, an inexplicable door sunk into the brickwork. Mighty cast-iron pipework clamped in rusting brackets and carrying no one knew what. Such brutal invention belonged to a race of supermen. She herself mopped floors and tied bandages. Did she really have the strength for this journey? When she stepped out from under the bridge, crossing a wedge of dusty morning sunlight, the train was making a harmless, clicking suburban sound as it receded. What she needed, Bryony told herself yet again, was backbone. She passed a tiny municipal park with a tennis court on which two men in flannels were hitting a ball back and forward, warming up for a game with lazy confidence. There were two girls in khaki shorts on a bench nearby reading a letter. She thought of her letter, her sugar-coated rejection slip. She had been carrying it in her pocket during her shift, and the second page had acquired a crab-like stain of carbolic. She had come to see that, without intending to, it delivered a significant personal indictment. Might she come between them in some disastrous fashion? Yes, indeed. And having done so, might she obscure the fact by concocting a slight, barely clever fiction, and satisfy her vanity by sending it off to a magazine? The interminable pages about light and stone and water, a narrative split between three different points of view, the hovering stillness of nothing much seeming to happen, none of this could conceal her cowardice. Did she really think she could hide behind some borrowed notions of modern writing and drown her guilt in a stream, three streams, of consciousness? The evasions of her little novel were exactly those of her life. Everything she did not wish to confront was also missing from her novella and was necessary to it. What was she to do now? It was not the backbone of a story that she lacked. It was backbone. She left the little park behind and passed a small factory whose thrumming machinery made the pavement vibrate. There was no telling what was being made behind those high, filthy windows, or why yellow and black smoke poured from a single slender aluminum stack. Opposite, set in a diagonal across a street corner, the wide-open double doors of a pub suggested a theatre stage. Inside, where a boy with an attractive, pensive look was emptying ashtrays into a bucket, last night's air still had a bluish look. Two men in leather aprons were unloading beer barrels down a ramp from the dray cart. She had never seen so many horses on the streets. The military must have requisitioned all the lorries. Someone was pushing open the cellar trapdoors from inside. They banged against the pavement, sending up the dust, and a man with a tonsure, whose legs were still below street level, paused and turned to watch her go by. He appeared to her like a giant chess piece. The draymen were watching her too, and one of them wolf-whistled. "All right, darling?" She didn't mind, but she never knew how to reply. "Yes, thank you." She smiled at them all, glad of the folds of her cape. Everyone, she assumed, was thinking about the invasion. But there was nothing to do but keep on. Even if the Germans came, people would still play tennis or gossip or drink beer. Perhaps the wolf whistling would stop. As the street curved and narrowed, the steady traffic along it sounded louder, and the warm fumes blew into her face. A Victorian terrace of bright red brick faced right onto the pavement. A woman in a paisley apron was sweeping with demented vigour in front of her house, through whose open door came the smell of fried breakfast. She stood back to let Bryony pass, for the way was narrow here, but she looked away sharply at Bryony's good morning. Approaching her were a woman and four jug-eared boys with suitcases and knapsacks. The kids were jostling and shouting and kicking along an old shoe. They ignored their mother's exhausted cry as Bryony was forced to stand aside and let them pass.
"Leave off, will you? Let the nursie through."
As she passed, the woman gave a lopsided smile of rueful apology. Two of her front teeth were missing. She was wearing a strong perfume, and between her fingers she carried an unlit cigarette.
"They're so excited about going in the countryside. Never been before, would you believe?"
Bryony said, "Good luck. I hope you get a nice family." the woman, whose ears also protruded, but were partially obscured by her hair cut in a bob, gave a gay shout of a laugh. "They don't know what they're in for with this lot." She came at last to a confluence of shabby streets, which she assumed from the detached quarter of her map was Stockwell. Commanding the route south was a pillbox, and standing by it, with only one rifle between them, was a handful of bored home guards. An elderly fellow in a trilby, overalls and armband, with drooping jowls like a bulldog's, detached himself and demanded to see her identity card. Self-importantly, he waved her on. She thought better of asking him directions. As she understood it, her way lay straight along the Clapham Road for almost 2 miles. There were fewer people here and less traffic, and the street was broader than the one she had come up. The only sound was the rumble of a departing tram. By a line of smart Edwardian flats, set well back from the road, she allowed herself to sit for half a minute on a low parapet wall in the shade of a plane tree and remove her shoe to examine a blister on her heel. A convoy of 3-ton lorries went by, heading south out of town. Automatically, she glanced at their backs, half expecting to see wounded men. But there were only wooden crates. 40 minutes later, she reached Clapham Common Tube Station. A squat church of rumpled stone turned out to be locked. She took out her father's letter and read it over again. A woman in a shoe shop pointed her toward the common. Even when Bryony had crossed the road and walked onto the grass, she did not see the church at first. It was half concealed among trees and leaf, and was not what she expected. She had been imagining the scene of a crime, a Gothic cathedral, whose flamboyant vaulting would be flooded with brazen light of scarlet and indigo from a stained-glass backdrop of lurid suffering. What appeared among the cool trees as she approached was a brick barn of elegant dimensions like a Greek temple, with a black-tiled roof, windows of plain glass, and a low portico with white columns beneath a clock tower of harmonious proportions. Parked outside, close to the portico, was a polished black Rolls-Royce. The driver's door was ajar, but there was no chauffeur in sight. As she passed the car, she felt the warmth of its radiator, as intimate as body heat, and heard the click of contracting metal. She went up the steps and pushed on the heavy, studded door. The sweet, waxy smell of wood, the watery smell of stone, were of churches everywhere. Even as she turned her back to close the door discreetly, she was aware that the church was almost empty. The vicar's words were in counterpoint with their echoes. She stood by the door, partly screened by the font, waiting for her eyes and ears to adjust. Then she advanced to the rear pew and slid along to the end, where she still had a view of the altar. She had been to various family weddings, though she was too young to have been at the grand affair in Liverpool Cathedral of Uncle Cecil and Aunt Hermione, whose form and elaborate hat she could now distinguish in the front row. Next to her were Piero and Jackson, lankier by 5 or 6 inches, wedged between the outlines of their estranged parents. On the other side of the aisle were 3 members of the Marshall family. This was the entire congregation. A private ceremony. No society journalists. Bryony was not meant to be there. She was familiar enough with the form of words to know that she had not missed the moment itself. "Secondly, it was ordained for a remedy against sin and to avoid fornication, that such persons as have not the gift of continency might marry and keep themselves undefiled members of Christ's body." Facing the altar, framed by the elevated white-sheeted shape of the vicar, stood the couple. She was in white, the full traditional wear, and as far as Bryony could tell from the rear, was heavily veiled. Her hair was gathered into a single childish plait that fell from under the froth of tulle and organdy and lay along the length of her spine. Marshall stood erect, The lines of his padded morning suit shoulders etched sharply against the vicar's surplice. Thirdly, it was ordained for the mutual society, help and comfort, that the one ought to have of the other. She felt the memories, the needling details like a rash, like dirt on her skin. Lola coming to her room in tears, her chafed and bruised wrists, and the scratches on Lola's shoulder and down Marshall's face. Lola's silence in the darkness at the lakeside as she let her earnest, ridiculous, oh-so-prim younger cousin, who couldn't tell real life from the stories in her head, deliver the attacker into safety. Poor, vain and vulnerable Lola, with the pearl-studded choker and the rosewater scent, who longed to throw off the last restraints of childhood, who saved herself from humiliation by falling in love, or persuading herself she had, and who could not believe her luck when Bryony insisted on doing the talking and blaming. And what luck that was for Lola, barely more than a child, prized open and taken, to marry her rapist. Therefore, if any man can show any just cause why they may not be lawfully joined together, let him now speak, or else hereafter forever hold his peace. Was it really happening? Was she really rising now with weak legs and empty contracting stomach and stuttering heart and moving along the pew to take a position in the centre of the aisle and setting out her reasons, her just causes, in a defiant, untrembling voice as she advanced in her cape and headdress like a bride of Christ toward the altar, toward the open-mouthed vicar who had never before in his long career been interrupted, toward the congregation of twisted necks and the half-turned, white-faced couple? She had not planned it, but the question, which she had quite forgotten from the Book of Common Prayer, was a provocation. And what were the impediments exactly? Now was her chance to proclaim in public all the private anguish and purge herself of all that she had done wrong, before the altar of this most rational of churches. But the scratches and bruises were long healed, and all her own statements at the time were to the contrary. Nor did the bride appear to be a victim, and she had her parents' consent. More than that, surely. A chocolate magnet, the creator of ammo. Aunt Hermione would be rubbing her hands. That Paul Marshall, Lola Quincy and she, Bryony Tallis, had conspired with silence and falsehoods to send an innocent man to jail. But the words that had convicted him had been her very own, read out loud on her behalf in the county court. The sentence had already been served, the debt was paid, the verdict stood. She remained in her seat, with her accelerating heart and sweating palms, and humbly inclined her head. I require and charge you both, as ye will answer at the dreadful day of judgment, when the secrets of all hearts will be disclosed, that if either of you know of any impediment why ye may not be lawfully joined together in matrimony, ye do now confess it. By any estimate, it was a very long time until Judgment Day, and until then the truth that only Marshall and his bride knew at first hand was steadily being walled up within the mausoleum of their marriage. There it would lie, secure in the darkness, long after anyone who cared was dead. Every word in the ceremony was another brick in place. Who giveth this woman to be married to this man? Bird-like Uncle Cecil stepped up smartly, no doubt anxious to be done with his duty before hurrying back to the sanctuary of All Souls, Oxford. Straining to hear any wavering doubt in their voices, Bryony listened to Marshall, then Lola, repeating the words after the vicar. Marshall boomed expressionlessly. Lola was sweet and sure. How flagrantly sensually it reverberated before the altar when she said, "With my body I thee worship." "Let us pray." Then the six outlined heads in the front pews drooped, and the vicar removed his tortoiseshell glasses, lifted his chin,